Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. I am your host, Nick Bilton. So a few months ago, a friend of mine came over for dinner, and I was talking about how I struggle with social media, how I delete the apps from my phone, and they somehow get reinstalled and things like that. And he told me, and this is someone who has worked in tech for a very long time, including in some social companies, that he recently decided that was it. He was done. He was done fighting the algorithms of Facebook and Instagram and so on. So he went onto these websites. He changed his password to a series of random numbers that he wrote down and put into an email address, a completely new email address that he created. He put all these passwords in there, and then he created a new password for this new random email address that's a series of about 30 letters and numbers, which he then wrote down on a piece of paper and hid inside his house. So if he ever wants to go back to social media, which he doesn't, but just to ensure that he won't, he has to go through this escape room-like experience to go find the password and re-enter them and everything. The thing that's really amazing about this story is not that we all want to quit social media, but it is the lengths that we have to go to try to quit. And the reason for that is because there are algorithms in these platforms that are trying to get inside your soul. So my guest today is not the friend who quit social media, but it is someone who is trying to lead the charge in Silicon Valley to help people understand how these algorithms are essentially becoming drugs and destroying their lives and how you can fight back against them. And at the same time, he is trying to convince Silicon Valley engineers and people like Mark Zuckerberg and folks at Google and Twitter and elsewhere to start to think more ethically about the role that they play in the way these social media apps essentially just fuck with our brains. So his name is Tristan Harris, and he has been called by The Atlantic as the closest thing to Silicon Valley has to a conscience. He spent years at Google as a design ethicist and developed a framework of how we should essentially ethically create technologies that are seen on billions of people's screens. And I'm really excited to welcome him to the show today. Tristan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So you are what's your name these days? What's your title? Is it like Superman, anti-tech, save the world person? Like, what is it?
The thing that always goes around is people have called me the moral conscience of Silicon Valley.
The moral conscience of Silicon Valley. What do you call yourself?
Well, we started this thing called the Center for Humane Technology, and that's how I think of what we're doing. But I used to be a design ethicist at Google, where I was studying how do you ethically shape or steer or manipulate 2 billion people's thoughts.
Okay, so before we get to the moral compass of Silicon Valley, because I don't think there are a lot of morals in Silicon Valley, so this will be a good thing for us to address. But the 2 billion thoughts on Google. You started this thing, but that's not what you started out. You started out as a tech person. We actually met a decade ago.
That's right. I was a tech entrepreneur. I was 22. I had dropped out of my master's degree at Stanford and started a tech company that sold its products to people like the New York Times and Washington Post and Economist. And we were actually in the game of trying to build, you know, a tech. We succeeded. Later sold our company Apture to Google. So I come from a perspective of understanding how it works to be an entrepreneur. And my friends started Instagram and all the, were early at many of the successful tech companies. And it's through that lens that I think I come from a very grounded place about what it would take for us to fix all this stuff.
So, and all the stuff is the fact that you think that the world that we live in today, and I do agree with you, but I want to hear it from the moral ethicist's mouth, that we're building technologies that are going to destroy the planet, or that it's, is it that extreme, or is it to another length of, people are kind of wasting their time on Instagram and things like that?
No, the wasting time thing, it's really unfortunate with this phrase, time well spent, which, you know, was a name for an advocacy group that we were sort of, was the vehicle for this work for a while, because it made people think that the problem is people aren't spending their time well. And that's not at all what it's about. It's about, we have one instrument to navigate the world, and that instrument is our mind. That's it. And can you screw up a human mind? Can you pull on so many of its psychological levers that it can't tell what's real from what's not real anymore, what's true from what's not true, or pull on its social validation, its social approval, or social reciprocity? If you pull enough of those levers, you can completely inhibit a human mind from being a functioning instrument to either navigate freely or to know or to think freely, or to not be subject to, you know, abuse from third parties or even foreign actors like Russia.
So, but isn't that essentially what Instagram, Google, Facebook, Twitter, all of these things are doing? The algorithm is designed to make you click, and yep. It is designed to essentially fuck with you. You know, I it's funny. I was just, I deleted everything from my phone, as a lot of people I know have done lately. And I still am logged. I'm not logged in on Facebook on my computer, because I don't trust them to, and I never have, it's a new computer. I've never logged in on with them, and I won't, because I don't want them to follow me on there. But I still am logged in on the mobile app, on the mobile website, sorry, on my phone. And a couple of weeks ago, I was still able, and I do that because some people message me once in a while through work stuff.
Yep.
And I went to go and check my messages the other day, and it now says that they won't let me see the message unless I download Messenger. And I was like, no fucking way I'm downloading Messenger.
On your phone or on the desktop?
On my phone.
On your phone.
Yeah, they will not let you. It's
yeah,
like,
you have to download
it's
Messenger
the most,
now.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
Well, that's a good example of, these are all persuasive techniques. It's like, oh, you want this? Well, to have that, you have to do this other thing that I want you to do. And so they're pairing your reasons with their reasons, and they're making it impossible to separate. But to your point, so yes, all of these companies, as at the point I've been trying to make for 5 years, are caught in this, you know, it's not maliciously intentional, it's not evil, it's just that their business model is capturing attention. And so it started with, how can we throw some persuasive techniques at people's minds to get their attention? And that worked pretty well. And then now you have this AI arms race where YouTube is throwing its AIs at people's brains and saying, how can I most make you forget the reason why you came here, and instead make you do what I want you to do, which is watch these other videos? Or Facebook says, how can I most make you forget why you came here and make you keep scrolling for as long as possible? And with AIs, when we know how AIs work, they're seeing more moves ahead on the chessboard than we can see. And that's why when we land there, we think, oh no, this time I'm just going to watch this one video. And next thing I know, I wake up out of a trance an hour and a half later and like, what the hell happened? It's because it was playing chess against our mind and it was beating us and we didn't even notice.
But isn't the only way for humans to win that game is not to play it?
Right, which is also speaks to, we need to design this entire stack differently. And that's what we're trying to do. We're basically saying this is an unsustainable existential threat to our capacity to solve any problem. Like, a society's capacity to solve its problems is its ability to reflect on what's important and to sustain its attention on those things and to change things. And we can't do that in this world where we have too many things eating away at our attention.
Do you think that technology is inherently does these things where it
no.
creates bad? No.
No,
you don't think it?
No, Photoshop. No, we're never worried about Photoshop. Like, oh my God, the kids these days—they're ruining. It's ruining society. They're lonely.
The Secret Service was worried about, you know, they made them add software that would make it so you couldn't, you know, scan dollar bills and things like that. I mean, there are
sure.
some worries, but
oh, of course, yeah, but not like civilization threatening or fabric of society threatening consequences.
Got
like,
it.
If you give kids a bicycle or a paintbrush or, you know, a pencil, you don't say, oh my God, we're going to ruin kids, you know, dopamine receptors and make them feel false social obligation and make them send, you know, make them feel less than enough and have beautification filters. I mean, none of that existed with basic tools like a bicycle. So there's something different that's going on. Specifically, this is actually really important because the industry, and I know specifically there are C-level executives at some of the major tech companies who to this day believe that this is nothing new. we've always been worried about media. We've always been worried about technology and what the kids are going to do these days. And we worried about newspapers. People aren't going to talk to each other. And they let that excuse get in the way of realizing we need to make dramatic and immediate changes. So let's talk about those four distinct things that are completely new. So the first thing is that we have technology that is totally intimate to our lives, meaning from the moment we go to bed at night and we set our alarm to the moment we wake up in the morning and we undo our alarm with our phone, we are jacked into an environment. We check our phones 150 times a day. And so we have this intimate access that was never before true. With computers even, we use them as occasional devices that we accessed, not we live by them moment to moment, checking 150 times a day. So that's the first thing, is intimate access. The second is social intermediation. The fact that it actually has changed and taken the place of how we communicate with every single person in our lives. TV didn't do that. Radio didn't do that. TV didn't, when you turn it on in the morning, show you photo after photo after photo of your friends having fun without you.
That's a good job, because I would have probably been a really sad teenager if it had.
Right. And yet now we've subjected...
Oh, I can't even comprehend how you're a teenager today.
We have subjected hundreds of millions of teenagers to total psychological terrorism and abuse. Fear of missing out, social validation. And it's also not done accidentally. It's also done by design in some cases.
So this is the question that I have is you know, and I know these folks, but you know them really, really well, have worked alongside them. Do they just not care? Is it that they don't think that they're doing something bad? Are they just unethical? Like, what is it?
Well, these are all really good people who are, have a belief system that justifies what they're doing, and they can look at the positive sides. There's the Me Too movement. There's people connecting with each other, having 10,000 fans on Instagram, and they walk down the street and someone says hi to them, and they could become famous at an early age. And there's these positive things. But I think what we have to get used to is the incentives of the people who make this technology are not aligned with the goals of society. This is an extraction-based model. The business model of advertising or attention is I want to extract attention from your life, from every part of your life, whether that attention used to exist between a parent and a child, or you in your sleep, or you in self-reflection. My job as a business is to suck the attention out of all those places and privately profit off of that, and then publicly harm, right? So the mental health, loneliness, externalities don't show up on the balance sheets of tech companies. Public polarization, election manipulation never shows up on the balance of tech companies. The costs on attention and cognition and feeling stressed and anxious and fearful all the time doesn't show up on the balance sheets of companies.
I'm feeling stressed and anxious right now talking to you.
Well, and so that's one of our projects, is that just like any open loop system, you have to say, what's the true cost of free? So actually one of our projects with the Center for Human Technologies, we're building a ledger of externalities, a ledger of harms, of what are all those things that are showing up on the balance sheets of society that are pushed onto society from tech, but that are basically coming from the extraction model of technology companies.
So when you look at when you talk about all those things, I'll tell you a little story. I have a friend, you probably know the person, I won't say their name. She was a big exec in tech media and tech, and recently just left the company and was telling me. I said, "Are you still on social media?" And they said, "I'm off everything." And I was like, "Well, like, how did you? What did you do?" And they said that they deleted all the apps from their phone. They changed their password for every single app to a series of random numbers, which they wrote down in an email, created a brand new email address, which they sent to that email address. The brand new email address is a 50-character random series of numbers for that email address, which is written on a piece of paper, stored away in a storage closet.
So it's like
closet.
Multiple layers of Ulysses contracts. Ulysses tying his hands behind the mast, and except there's multiple layers of that.
It's multiple layers of that. And it's funny because when he told me that, I wasn't like, oh, that's crazy. I was like, oh, that's how you do it. Because I don't use Instagram. I just literally find nothing appealing about it whatsoever. I used to in the early days. I barely ever go to Facebook unless it's something for work. Twitter and I are in a abusive relationship where it abuses me when I log in and I log out every few days and but feel the need to kind of know what's going on. And I feel like the only way you can win is to not play. And how you, I understand what you're saying about you can fix it, but how can you fix it?
Well, so the fixing isn't about how we use adversarial technologies. These are all adversarial technologies, right? I mean, you have hundreds of engineers on the other side of the screen whose job is to defeat your agency and to make you to do what they want you to do. So we don't want to use, you know, have healthy use of adversarial technologies that are all meant to defeat your self-control, your well-being, all this kind of stuff. So the answer is you have to change it. You have to change it from the ground up.
You have to change it from the app side and the product side?
No,
or
this isn't like Barbara's organic food store of cool apps that are better for you. This is like, let's change it from the home screens, from notifications, rebuilding like the city from the ground up. Think of this like a city. So we're jacked into an environment that we basically live inside of 24/7, when we check our phones 150 times a day. And what we need to do is change the urban planning. And there's a difference between an urban plan like LA, where we are, which theoretically is built for people, but is actually built around cars in the same way that the iPhone today is kind of built around apps, versus a city like, or urban plan more like Jane Jacobs' idea of New York and the livable cities movement, where we can design it to be around the contours and shapes of what it means to be human, like walking stoops, sidewalk stoops, you know, eyes on the street, things like that. So we want to reorganize the actual content of the city. So on a home screen on a phone, it's like an urban plan. And right now it's like no zoning laws, no building codes. Everyone's like, build a casino on the front door. So the second you open up your mind, you open up your eyes, you're jacked into a bunch of casinos. And that is not healthy. And there's a different way to design it where that's not how the urban plan works.
But okay, but there are billions of people on the internet. Yeah. There are a billion plus people with smartphones that are walking straight into that casino every day. There are, I mean, look, just last week, Facebook, you know, this month alone, Facebook sat in front of Congress, talked, you know, Zuckerberg talked about all these ways in which they track you and do all these crazy things and know all these insane things about you that most people don't know. And yet for their quarterly earning report, they added 70 million new users and their daily actives are up X amount. And I guess the two questions are, how do you get people out of the casino? A and B, if you wanted to redesign LA as a city, doesn't necessarily work for the number of cars that exists today. If you want to get past the famous 405, like there's no way for them to fix that. How do you fix this system where billions of people are using it in constant?
So how long would it take Apple or Google to change how home screens and notifications work?
It would not change them. It would probably take an engineer an afternoon, but maybe even less than an afternoon coffee. But does Google and Apple want you to use the device that they need to sell you and engage with you, and their stock is driven based on how much people use it? Do they want to do that?
That's the thing, is this is just like, you know, did people want Whole Foods until there was a decade and a half of kind of public awareness about how bad our industrial food supply had gotten, right? So I think that what we're trying to do is create a cultural awakening. We don't use the phrase raise awareness because it's not raising awareness. This is more like cigarettes, where we were with cigarettes totally infatuated with this thing. It was totally great. And then we made a total cultural 180. We went from saying this is totally great and normal and we do it with each other to, whoa, completely the opposite sort of view. And I don't mean that that's how we're going to see phones as cigarettes. I just mean that our relationship to seeing all this stuff has to move from being infatuated with it to seeing this is all adversarial and bad for society, moreover unsustainable. We can't actually sustain ourselves with this. So that's the first change. And I actually forgot the thing that you just said right before that.
I was talking about how
my point is that Apple, if you told someone 4 years ago, do you want a phone that helps you use it less, before they understood this problem? This is what I try to do within Google. So let me give you my background. I made this presentation in 2013 warning everybody at Google that we are manipulating people's cognitive biases. We are exploiting the deepest human instincts in how they use technology. And we have a responsibility, a moral responsibility, to fix it. Now, when I tried to walk into the Android team and the Chrome team and said, hey, can we design these things in a way that protects people's minds and change how notifications work and change how home screens work, it would never get prioritized because consumers didn't, quote unquote, want it. But that's just because they didn't understand. And now we're at a point where the world is finally waking up to this thing. We're at about a one-year anniversary of 60 Minutes. I was on 60 Minutes a year ago, and we talked about brain hacking. And we said, basically, this entire game is who's better at getting your attention, which means who's better at, you know, racing down your brainstem to play deeper and deeper tricks. First, it was your behavior. Now I have to actually do, instead of behavior modification, I have to do identity modification and belief modification. I have to go down deep into your sense of self-approval and actually to hijack your way of knowing that you feel like you're enough as a teenager by connecting that to the number of likes you got. So we had to kind of expose this conversation for what it is, just like the tobacco thing. 60 Minutes, you know, there was the insider talking about what the tobacco was doing. This is that for technology, except it's not one bad company. It's a model. It's a business model. That's the tobacco ingredient. And that business model is the advertising model. It's the most pernicious and corrosive business model that it gives us the illusion of something that is free while costing us everything. And that's what we're basically meant to, you know, going out there to change.
So do you, is your goal to take Facebook, for example, and try to give them a roadmap to do things differently? Or is Facebook a lost cause and it's more the actual apps? I mean, the OS on your phone and things like that.
Unfortunately, it requires a coordinated redesign among all the actors. It takes Apple and Google doing some different stuff at the device level, and it takes the media, the social media and other companies doing different things within the app level.
Okay, so I completely understand that. And it's it like communism, it's fantastic on paper. However,
right. How are you going to do it?
Well, no, I mean, look at, I don't want to, I know you're friends with these people, so I don't necessarily, I'm not trying to get you to talk shit about them. But Mark Zuckerberg, for example, wants to rule the world.
And they want to defend their very profitable business model. They don't want to get off advertising.
What is the incentive for Mark? If he goes before Congress, you know, is accused of X, Y, and Z, admits to the fact that they have this advertising system in place that literally knows more about you than you know about yourself.
Correct.
And yet, revenue's up, user numbers are up.
Right. And it's because people don't have, frankly, we're not armed with the right cultural counter arguments. Because when I say the advertising model is a problem, I'll tell you what the Facebook engineers will say. They'll say, look, people like the ads. They like the rectangles. They like, you know, if you give someone a copy of Vanity Fair with the ads versus without the ads, they probably prefer it with the ads. Therefore, why would people pay to have Facebook without the ads? Sounds very convincing, doesn't it? They've really refined their arguments. It's total. It's not true.
You can curse on here. It's totally right. Fine. We're a cursing family here.
It is not true. I mean, this also isn't a philosophical conversation. This is a really serious conversation. So it's important we really understand what's at stake. The problem with the advertising model isn't the ads. It's not the rectangle. It's the fact you have automated systems that are pointing predatorily at the human brain and saying, how can I most exploit your deepest weaknesses, right? So the fact, so here, let me give you an example. There's this sort of urban legend right now that I was just talking to you over lunch about some new brand of shoes that I like. And next thing I know, open up my Facebook news feed and those shoes are showing up at the top of my feed. Holy shit.
Yep.
Right? So this thing must have been listening on the microphone.
Yep.
Except here's the deal. It actually is not listening on the microphone.
What's it doing?
This speaks to what we're talking about. The advertising model is not that the ad shows up. How does it know what shoes to show up there? It's using AI, meaning it doesn't even have to listen to your microphone because the prediction is so good that it only has to know who you tend to talk to, what kind of person you are, what demographics, you know, clusters you fit into. And it knows exactly what to put at the top of your newsfeed. And you only notice and get that paranoia when you happen to have just talked about it in your conversations, which is why...
That's scarier than the microphone listening in.
Right. And that's what people should be focused on, is the fact that this is the daily life that you... This is our daily lives. You open up Facebook newsfeed, you're activating an AI pointed at your brain to prey on your deepest psychological instincts. They had that study in Australia where they claimed to sell advertisers in Australia on the fact that they know when teens feel low self-esteem, feel anxious, feel you know.
This is Facebook.
This is Facebook, yeah. And the thing is, it's worse than that. They're going to know when people are depressed. They're going to know when you're about to leave a relationship. They're
going
to know.
Well, not only are they going to know,
when you're open to changing who your voting preferences are.
They can manipulate how if you're depressed and if you're not based on the things they show you in the newsfeed.
Knowing that you're depressed, I could start your newsfeed with photo after photo of your ex-romantic partners smiling with someone else. And I then, could do but, that if I
okay,
wanted
now,
to.
Okay, now, so what is to stop Facebook or another company? Because I don't believe that there is – I think that – I'm sure that someone on the ad sales team has pitched this idea already. But what is to stop them from, you know, from presenting you with those things to make you depressed and then to pushing some sort of ad for – you know, antidepressants or something like that, that it you then see, which you then click on because you're feeling sad and therefore they get more clicks on the ads.
So they would claim that that would not be in their long-term business interest, that if they do that kind of thing for long enough, people would burn out of Facebook and not use the product. But, you know, I frankly, the answer really is that there's nothing that stops them from doing that. There's nothing that stops them from tipping the scales in any election and saying, hey, you know, they have this feature called the get out the vote feature, which shows when people have, around you have voted and you can mark that you voted. They apparently said that that increases voting rates by 0.24%, right? So now what's to stop them from using that feature with certain people, with certain political party biases and not with others? There's no way, there's no accountability. They have more power than any world government.
Yep.
And no one is holding them accountable except for Wall Street, which basically says, are you better and better at manipulating people's minds or not every quarter?
And you truly do believe that you can change this?
Yes. Because we have to. Because if we had to live in this, we're all gone anyway. So, and when, here's the optimism. When you understand how dangerous a threat this poses to society, there's actually no human being who wants to live in that society. If I showed you where this is going to go for children and how this is going to affect kids growing up,
well,
and these
tell
people
us. Show us.
Well, no, I mean, we can talk about that, but I just mean when people understand where this is all going, that we're basically talking about a business model which incentivizes the shredding of truth so people don't agree on what's true, because I do better when to get your attention if I personalize your feed and personalize someone else's feeds, and if they have different facts and different truth, I get more attention that way. If I do better when I uproot kids' self-worth and I make them, you know, hooked and have these beautification filters or like these funny anime type things on them that make them feel like they have to sort of pretty themselves up, that world no one wants to live in. And the fastest route to changing this, the reason why I'm optimistic, is that it's almost like, do you believe in Anakin Skywalker that you can sort of find the good in them? I mean, I think the tech engineers actually everyone I know and you know as well, they have good intentions. They're good people who think that they're making a positive impact. They've been sold this narrative that we're about making the world more open and connected in the case of Facebook or the platform for free speech. And these were really attractive narratives. And when you see that the business model that drives those things is completely not that, in fact, the business model arguably makes the world more closed and disconnected, that, you know, no one wants that. And I think that's the fastest lever for change, because it's really hard to sustain your business model if you can't hire and retain the best talent. And that's already been happening. There's a lot of people leaving these companies because they don't feel good. And this is also what changed Uber, by the way.
Where are these people going?
I don't know.
Are they going
from one social media company
to
another?
Yeah, or are they, you know, starting nonprofits, or are they, you know, trying to do things that are... I think that the reality is, and this is not meant as any disrespect, but no. There are very few companies in Silicon Valley that are actually legitimately
doing good.
And those ones you don't hear about because they're too focused on doing good to try to get themselves in Business Insider or whatever. Yep. So it seems this is the famous quote, you know, that the brightest minds of my generation are trying to figure out how to get you to click on ads better. Like, what are people in the Valley doing that is good and is better when they leave these companies?
Well, not that much. And I think this actually speaks to the regulation conversation, because part of the honest truth is that we have some monopolies that constrain competition. They've actually inhibited innovation and growth. And that we might actually have to have a conversation about opening up those channels so that they don't control the cost of customer acquisition.
Those companies, and when I speak to people in Silicon Valley about this, those companies are, you know, Facebook, I truly do believe, wants to be regulated because it ensures that no one else can ever grow to the size of Facebook. You know, Zuck and company bent and broke and got around so many rules because the people that do run our government, whether it's a Democratic government or a Republican government, have no earthly fucking idea how technology works. I mean, if those questions for Zuck at Congress, I mean, were borderline embarrassed. I mean, no, they were past embarrassing, in my opinion. There were maybe two or three senators that actually asked intelligent questions, and Zuck didn't even answer those. And I don't understand, you know, and I think that what Facebook knows is if they get regulated, it ensures that no one else can do the things they
did. Depends on how they're regulated. I mean, the 1956 AT&T consent decree basically created the internet, created like the modern Silicon Valley, because mm-hmm. it enabled the transistor and a bunch of patents to get, you know, pushed out, and then it restricted AT&T to not go into certain kinds of businesses. And that basically helped open up the innovation of Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And I think there's different moves like that that we're trying to figure out now. What is that going to look like that's going to open up innovation? Because then there's a place for those tech employees to go where they can actually focus on what's doing good.
Are you, is your group trying to talk to people in Congress and so on?
Yeah, we were involved in briefing the major members of Congress on both the House and Senate side before the Russia investigations on November 1st, those hearings with the three major tech platforms. Yep. And I think...
Did you get the impression when you were briefing them, and I know a lot of it's just aides and things like that, but did you get the intention that they recognized how serious this was, or was it much more...
I think in the process of our educating them and serving as a resource for them, you know, prior to that, I think there was a lot of preferencing of, you know, secret cables and signals intelligence and that kind of stuff on Russia, right? It's like, let's look at all of our special tools. And there wasn't as much a focus on the social media platforms because that's not the area that everybody understands. But when we kind of showed that this is what you can use to create a culture war, that these feeds automatically preference negative emotions, outrage, fear, they spread faster and work better at being at the top of people's feeds than the other side. That was new for, you know, the folks that we were talking to. So I actually think we had a dramatic impact in educating members of Congress and how those hearings went. Senator Blumenthal wrote that letter to Facebook saying you need to notify everybody who's affected by Russian propaganda by hauling them to Congress. We actually got the real numbers out of them. Keep in mind, you cannot trust these companies to self-regulate. If you asked Facebook how many people were affected by Russian propaganda, they said, oh, I don't know, a million or two. And they didn't actually reveal the actual number, 126 million, which is 90% of the U.S. voting population, until we hauled them to Congress. And you got to do that, because that's why I'm actually optimistic, because it's not necessarily about getting all the right regulation. It's about creating the pressure that forces the companies to change. And each time you bring them to Congress or you bring them to the EU, it forces them to answer certain questions, to create policies. And yeah, they're always going to do less than what they should. But the pressure, the counter pressure, is what's been even creating some of the changes that we've seen to date.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
So if you listen to this podcast like me, you probably don't get a lot of sleep. You're worrying about alien invasions and AI taking over the world. But the folks at Mattress Firm want to help. So Mattress Firm, aka America's Neighborhood Mattress Store, can help you stretch your budget a little further when you're looking for ways to improve your sleep. The folks at Mattress Firm are mattress experts. Yes, experts. And they're not just mattress experts in explaining mattresses, but they can help you build your bed from headboard to adjustable bases to sheets. They even have beautiful bedroom decor. They've got you covered literally and figuratively. So the experts at Mattress Firm are so worried about the sleep of people who listen to this podcast, because we're always talking about the apocalypse and all the bad things that are happening in the world, that they want to offer a special discount just for you. All you need to do is go to mattressfirm.com and you'll save 10% with the code PODCAST10. That's podcast number 10, PODCAST10. And you can save 10% on your favorite mattress, all the stuff that they offer. Mattress Firm offers a 120-night sleep trial to ensure perfection and a 120-night low-price guarantee, so that you know that the thing you paid for is perfect for you and you will sleep like a little baby. Once again, go to mattressfirm.com and enter that code PODCAST10 to get 10% off your mattress. So around the time that Zuck went to Congress, the EU actually asked him to go there too, and he said no. Do you think that that's going to backfire on him, and that they could enforce?
When was this? Was this recently?
This was right before. I think it was Theresa May had asked or something, and it was
Shripe just went there, I think, yesterday, right? For the CTO.
Yeah. And but it seems that you know, Americans are a little bit more lackadaisical around this, and Europe is not, because Europe really experienced the wars, World War One, World War Two, and so on and so forth, especially in Germany and in England. And it seems like they have a lot less patience there. Do you think that that could be one of the things that could lead to some sort of change in social media?
Yeah, I do think so. And I think that will increase over the next few months. I think that the EU will get more aggressive. I also think, you know, I think the U.S. Congress will get more aggressive. All it's going to take is simply showing the truth here, right? I mean, the truth is this business model of having AIs push thoughts into 2 billion people's brains without any accountability except whatever works the best is causing genocides in Burma, right? Mm-hmm. In languages that the engineers don't even speak, is manipulating and making vulnerable all these democracies around the world, creating instability and culture wars. There's no one who wants that except certain people who are trying to get that to happen. But no like regular set of citizens wants that world. No one wants a world where their kids are hooked and they can't do their homework and don't have attention.
But don't people have this thought that, oh, well, I get to keep track of my kids while they're on the internet, or I get to send pictures of my cappuccino to my friends on Instagram. It's okay if a few people in Burma, you know, end up killed in some sort of riot. I mean, isn't that, I mean, you saw the famous post by Boz at Facebook, which was like, you know, if we're connecting the world at any cost and some people get killed as a result, like that's just the cost.
Yeah. And I think that should reveal why this is such a huge problem and needs such change. Meaning, I don't think you can trust the culture of these companies if that's the thing that they're saying. I mean, would you trust someone who's a parent or someone who's, you know, a teacher at your kid's school who said that, you know, our goal is to do something at any cost, including when that cost is known to create genocides in foreign cultures, that real people's lives are at stake? I mean, there's certain things you can't, you know, choose, right? I mean, if you build, I've got a suitcase roller bag here. I'm sure a suitcase roller bag has, at some point in someone's history, when someone who invented that thing never thought that it would cause someone to die at some point in history, right? You can't prevent everything. But in this case, we know it's because of a business model. It's because of this system that says what put to the top of people's feeds, the thing that gets the most clicks or the most shares. And that has been leading to conspiracy theories getting spread, to fake news getting spread that's causing genocides around the world. So we have to change this.
So do you still use social media?
I use it occasionally.
What do you use?
Facebook and Twitter, specifically to get out information about what we're doing and what needs to happen.
Do you like put on a cloak before you log on to Facebook and say, you will not get me, I'm not going to click on the thing on the top of my screen, or do you, how do you use it?
I use it pretty normally, and I'm, you know, more aware than probably most people on earth of exactly how it manipulates people's psychology, and it still manipulates my own. You know, if you're a chimpanzee, you don't get to choose whether a banana seems appealing. Like,
yeah.
You're inside of the mind-body meat suit with the evolutionary instincts, which will drive you to want that thing. So when you're inside of a human meat suit with the evolutionary instincts of a human being, and you've got a slot machine variable reward when you check Twitter, and sometimes you have those 10 new notifications and sometimes you don't, it works on you whether you want it to or not. So, you know, but I do think there's ways, subtle ways you can change this stuff. You can turn off all notifications. You can set your screen to grayscale, which more and more people are doing, which is cool to see.
And wait, explain the grayscale thing for people that...
Well, so there's this thing where, you know, I think people underestimate the effect that color has on their brain. So, you know, the red color for notifications was chosen because it's a trigger color. It's the same reason why McDonald's is red and yellow.
And stop signs are red.
And stop signs are red, exactly. So that activates our brain in a subtle way. And again, just like a banana and a chimpanzee, you don't get to choose whether it does, it just does. So what do? You can turn off notifications, remove all those red dots. But something else you can do is, I think people don't realize that just by looking at your phone and seeing those colorful icons, it's lighting up some of your dopamine responses, even if you don't do anything, even if you just turn your phone over. So if you set your phone to grayscale, which you can do by going into settings, general, accessibility, and then scroll all the way to the bottom to this thing called accessibility shortcut, and set it to grayscale. What that does...
Or you can just Google that.
Or you just Google that, yeah, which actually this has been a tip. It's on humanetech.com. But we're not in the business of productivity tips for how to live better with your phone. That's not what this is about.
Yeah, yeah.
But the point is, we have to change the whole stack. But because that's going to take longer, people need to understand how this is operating on them right now. And there's some things you can do, including turning off notifications, setting your phone to grayscale, which helps a lot of people use it a little bit less.
Do you think that... as we look forward into the future, and you know, social media is a decade plus old. It is very, very, very young on the scale of all technologies that have been around. Do you think that AI is going to destroy society because it doesn't take a lot of people to build something that can go incredibly wrong?
I think what's amazing about this conversation is all the stuff about AI is the Terminator photos and the what if in the future we have runaway AI that you hook it up to the stock market and it tries to make us, uses its advanced intelligence to make more money than all the humans because it can outcompete them. And then it uses that money to try and figure out how it can reinvest into more computing infrastructure so it then can build paperclips or maximize something in the world. And it starts maximizing and starts sucking in all the world's resources, every mineral, everything, kills all the humans, and it does this thing. And we always worry about what if that were to happen in the future. That's like the, you know, thing people worry about. What we miss is that we've already created a runaway AI. The Facebook newsfeed is a runaway AI. Every minute you spend on it, it's generating more money off of you. It's extracting attention from you and making money. And then it's trying to figure out how can it more hook you. So it tries to enslave the human beings with better, it reinvests the money that it makes into more prediction power to better predict what will hook all these human animals that it's now hooked up to. And so it shows better and better things to them that keep them scrolling for longer and longer. So it makes even more money so it can predict even more moves ahead in the chessboard against the human beings that it's facing and better enslave them. And then it helps more and more advertisers do this in different countries and languages that the engineers don't even speak. And so we've already created this Frankenstein that's run amok around the world, that's creating total havoc. And all Mark Zuckerberg has to do is flip off the switch. But of course, he can't do that, which is the same thing we've said about runaway AI. We say, hey, look, in the future, if the AI is in a drone and it starts running around the world and killing people or something like that, at least what we know is we can pull the switch. But in the scenario is, well, what happens if it can reach the switch before you can and it stops you from doing it? In this case, we built this thing called a corporation in which we can't turn off the switch of a thing that's already run amok on society. Not when the business model is working so well, not when there's $500 billion of market value that are tied up in it. And so Zuckerberg is sitting on top of this thing that he created, and it's a really hard position to be in. I mean, there's no human experience of that happening ever in history, right? Like, our evolutionary instincts didn't give us a way to build a thing that's making all that money for all these people, supporting 50,000 people's well-being and kids going to school and people, employees at your company, and a bunch of people's pensions and savings and their stock price, and he can't shut the thing down.
Do you think that if Zuck could shut the thing down, he would? Or do you think for him the challenge of continuing to grow and being the biggest company on the planet is more important?
I'm really curious about his psychology.
Have you spoken to him since you started the group?
I've not spoken to him personally since I started the group. Although he did take our whole concept of time well spent and make it the new design goal for all of Facebook. But in doing so, co-opting it and not taking it seriously.
Got it. And have you, the people that you know that are close to him, do they tell you, I mean, do they think that he is riddled with guilt around what this thing became, or is it just like, okay, well, this is just one of the things I have to deal with?
You know, I think it's, you know, the Upton Sinclair line, which is that it's really hard to get people to question something that their salary depends on them not questioning.
Yeah.
And I think that he's somewhere in between from every signal I can tell. Everyone I know at Facebook is really willing to engage in a conversation about how they can make things better. And they're eager for feedback, and they're really good people that are trying really hard. And I think it's worth celebrating the people who are working late hours and trying to make sure fewer elections are manipulated. But every change they're willing to make has to do with, you know, it's like the business model sitting over here in this corner, and they're sort of standing in front of the business model, the elephant in the room, and saying, what do you want us to change outside of changing the core problem?
Let me ask you a question. So let's just pretend for a minute that you sold your company to Facebook years ago, and you worked your way up, and you realize all these things that you're telling me today, and something happens. Zuckerberg quits and goes to live in the woods or something, or is run over by a bus, and you are put in charge, and it's right now.
Yep.
Would you flip the switch?
I would first start by making an honest apology. I would say, I'm so sorry. I had no idea that this business model would cause these problems. I didn't see it at the time. But now that I do, let me tell you about our 5-year plan transition off of this pernicious business model. And just because, just in the same way that I've told you, I'm Zuckerberg, that I'm giving away, what, 95% of my wealth, 98% of my wealth to do philanthropic ventures, in recognizing that this is actually the most short-term existential threat to society, I'm going to redirect all that money into basically buying off the difference between what it would cost us to transition from the old business model to a better one. And I'm going to pay for that transition plan because I know that I'm responsible for creating this thing. And if he really cared about doing the most good for the world, he would see this fundamental threat and make that transition. Sounds insane, but I mean, I think that's where we are. We have to recognize we have created exponentially powerful systems that are exponentially non-accountable and are fundamentally, not by accident, but in their design, are, you know, destroying the fabric of society.
All right. So if you had to fast forward 10 years or maybe 5 years, and you can you give us the best case scenario and the worst case scenario for how this plays out?
Best case scenario is, like with cigarettes, we create a massive cultural awakening so that everyone is more skeptical of the existing social media products and don't want to use them as they have been designed and basically end up using their phones and social media a lot less, if at all, and recognize where they get lasting fulfillment, that when they have great dinner conversations with friends or they cook or they do whatever it is that they love doing, when they're doing the things that they love, they don't even feel the pull to check their phone. And that it's only in the moments of emptiness and anxiety that we even go for this anyway. And that we actually start steering people towards those choices. So in my vision, the whole point of what we're doing with the Center for Humane Technology is saying there's actually a different way to design business models, products, the actual product design, and organizational cultures that basically help people make these choices in their lives that they themselves find lasting and sustainable and enriching to the fabric of society. And that when, in other words, think of this rectangle in this pocket. So I think we're still going to have a rectangle about the size of a phone in our pockets.
You do?
I think that we will, yeah. I don't think we're going to read text on, contact lenses and look like zombies.
Isn't part of what we kind of envision the future to be a lot like the movie Her, where we talk to things and they talk to us, and rather than us constantly staring down at this stupid rectangle?
Yeah, I think in the long, long, long run, I mean, I think it's very hard to build things that are totally audio interfaces that summarize and can do full conversation.
Yeah.
So I just think that we're going to have this form factor of a rectangle in our pockets for a long time. And I think even in the movie Her, he has a rectangle in his pocket.
But it doesn't interact with the rectangle too much.
Correct. And I think that's actually a good thing. I think we're going to need conversational interfaces. And the reason we need conversational interfaces is that we think and choose very differently when we're in a conversation than when we're interacting with two-dimensional animating screens. It actually interacts. It produces totally different, or asks of us totally different parts. It recruits totally different parts of our minds to be interacting in those two different ways. But the point is that there's a way in which technology should be a GPS for our lives and help us to make choices. So right now, like my job at Google was, there's this 2 billion person ant colony called humanity. And it's going around, and you can see it from like this overview effect. You can see what it's doing. And then you suddenly imagine, what if I give every single one of those ants, every single one of those humans, a smartphone as they exist today in social media casinos? And they start going crazy. They're lonely. They're depressed. They're like comparing themselves all the time. They're hooked. The ant colony does a totally different set of behaviors. And so the design ethicist role was like, how do you ethically steer an entire 2 billion person ant colony of people's thoughts and the choices they make and the relationships they have? And the point is that there is a different way to give people a rectangle in their pocket that helps them make lasting life choices that do not produce these bad externalities that sort of hollow out the fabric of society.
Why did you leave Google then, if you could have affected that ant colony?
Because we needed to create the public conversation first. As I mentioned before, I tried to get Android and Chrome to change some of the ways they did the design and try and emphasize some of these principles. And I think there's very good people there too, but there wasn't enough of an understanding this was a serious threat. And so I left to, do the TED Talks in 60 Minutes and try to raise awareness slowly but surely. And here's the thing. As much as this sounds like a really scary sort of world that we're in and that it's really kind of depressing, because I feel that way too. But if you actually look back a year ago, I mean, honestly, 1 year ago, like, no one was talking about this stuff.
I was actually talking about it, but yeah, no one was listening.
So listen, you and I were both into. I mean, look, you and I were both had this background in the attention economy, understanding how the game works. But you know, we couldn't get the whole world to understand and care about this, right? And you know, I will say, I mean, a year ago was 60 Minutes. We just passed the anniversary, like a year and 2 weeks ago. Back when I did 60 Minutes, I would have, if you told me that a year later, Zuckerberg would be testifying before Congress, Cambridge Analytica and persuasion and manipulation would be front page headlines around the whole world. And every single day, this would be like one of the most talked about issues in the world. And we'd be talking about regulating tech companies. I would have never believed you. I mean, we have made enormous progress on this in the last year.
All right. So you gave me the best case scenario for 5-10 years out. What's the worst case scenario? Or a bad scenario. We don't have to go all the way to like robots are controlling society.
No, I think it's where we are right now is bad enough in and of itself. Where we're headed, it's like.
But if we don't fix this, it's going to get worse. What is worse?
What is worse? What's worse is, any time you look at technology, you will have the experience of less and less freedom. Meaning, you will feel more and more pulled to do things that you are not aware you are being pulled to do. We will manipulate and uproot children's sense of self-worth more and more effectively, and further hinder their development and screw with their impulse control systems starting from a very early age. We've never before, by the way, given kids this frequent a level of social validation occurring every 10 seconds with little drips of new likes. We've never done that to human animals in all human history. And I think generationally, we can't afford the cost of that generation growing up that way. So, you know, we'll live in a world where we don't agree on what's true. We feel like less and less ability to sustain our attention on anything, whether that's let's think about how we're going to solve climate change, let's think about how we're going to solve inequality, two of the most important problems in the world right now. We are not going to be able to think about or agree on anything, and we're going to feel more and more helpless and more distracted, amusing ourselves to death, as Brave New World Aldous Huxley predicted, you know, many, many years ago. And that's where we're headed unless we change it, which is why, again, because no one wants to live in that world, we have to change it and we can.
So what are some of the things that you have done in your own life? I mean, I'm sitting here, I still see you have a laptop and a smartphone and a wireless mouse. And you, I mean, it seems that I see a paper notebook too. But what are things that you have done that have changed as a result of the work you've been doing?
Well, you know, one of the reasons I started working on this is I personally struggle with this stuff. I imagine you do too. I mean, it's like when you use this stuff and you live in it, it starts screwing with your brain. I mean, mm-hmm. I have a very hard time reading books that I want to read and having the kind of focus I used to have. But it has gotten better. And I think, you know, turning off notifications helps a ton.
I've
full screening apps on desktop helps a ton. Go on.
I got rid of a lot of apps on my phone, but I did the whole thing, you know, turned off notifications, this, that, and the other. But one of the things that I found is I remember years ago I was speaking to a brain psychologist about repetition on devices and with anything. And one of the things that people do, I'm sure anyone has listening, and you and I have both done this, you'll be in a net, let's say you're in Twitter, and you're like, oh, I got to get out of Twitter. And you close it, and you instinctively, the next thing you do is open Twitter right in that second again.
Yep.
Because it becomes habit.
Exactly.
Not only did I get rid of all those apps on my phone, which I think is quite possibly the best thing I've done since getting the smartphone. But I also, in the place that they were, I put like the Kindle app and the Audible app and things like that. And so now I'm creating this new experience
And this is what humane design is all about. We have this image on our website, which is showing human evolution from monkeys all the way up to Neanderthals to humans and standing up. And then the question is, what happens after the human? And the next one is a human being that's bigger and turns around and looks back at their evolutionary instincts. In other words, the right way to design technology is actually by understanding that we have evolutionary instincts for habit formation. That's a vulnerability. And in fact, at the Persuasive Technology Lab, where I learned half these techniques and how this stuff works, the deliberate goal is how do you implant a habit in the human animal that you are dealing with? And use slot machines and other type rewards to do that. And so the premise of humane design is saying, knowing that that is a vulnerability of a human being, you know, just like I was a magician as a kid, like knowing that human minds have these vulnerabilities, instead of, you know, ripping the door off and letting anybody exploit them, which is what Apple and Google allow for today, we basically say, how do we help you extinguish the habits you don't want? And how do we help you have the habits you do want? And Apple, by the way, could actually have that built into the phone, saying once a month, like, here's basically the behaviors I see you having with me, the phone. And which of these do you want, and which ones do you want to extinguish, and let me help you extinguish the ones you don't want and help you have the ones you do want.
Will Apple ever do that?
I think our point is that we have to push them to do that, and we can do that.
So last few questions here before we wrap up. Why is there no, in the same way that there is a third way with a lot of things, why is there no third company? Why is there no tech company in Silicon Valley that is making made a phone that just has a camera, or, you know, doesn't allow you to be on social media, doesn't even have notifications, you know?
Well, there are a couple efforts, and they deserve more attention, because per your point, it's very hard when the monopolies and the patents are all owned by these like two major tech companies, and there's OEM deals with manufacturers, and it's really constrained space. It doesn't make it easy to start a new phone company these days. But there's something called Siempo for Android, which is an alternative home screen.
How do you spell that?
S-I-E-M-P-O, Siempo. Uh-huh. And they're an alternative home screen that actually uses a bunch of our design principles. It's awesome. They make your screen gray scale or black and white by default. They decolorize your icons. They batch and digest notifications, so you get all your notifications in one batch digest at the end of the day. They have you type in your intention when you start the day.
What do you mean type in your intention? Like,
I think like the thing that you want to get done today, or something like that. Yeah. There's a bunch of things that they implement, and that helps people a lot. Like, people are saying this is like their life is a lot better with it. There's an app called Moment that people can install on the iPhone, which tracks how much time you spend in every app. That's helped people a little bit. I was thinking of another example for Android. There's something called Light Phone, which is
the Light Phone.
Yeah. And it makes phone calls and lets you order Ubers and just have the core features, and it takes off all the rest.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, this is a solvable problem. You know, it's not like we have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. This is not an anti-technology conversation. It's a humane technology conversation.
All right. So you're going around Silicon Valley and you're espousing all these things. And I used to live in Silicon Valley and had some difficult and uncomfortable conversations with people there. Are you kind of a pariah now there? Like, do you walk into a restaurant sometimes and everyone just leaves and you're kind of left alone?
Well, the interesting thing is, I don't think anything I'm saying is an opinion. What I mean by that is, I'm just revealing logical facts. You know, are these companies locked in a race to get attention? Yes. Do they have to start doing features like autoplay YouTube videos and slot machine rewards to get people to use the products? Yes. These are not opinions. These are facts. And so I think people, you know, I've been reached out to by thousands and thousands of engineers and designers saying, thank you for speaking up and telling the truth. I think actually everybody wants to live in the world that we're talking about. We just actually have to pave the way to get there. And that's a hard thing. It's a long thing. But, you know, I think in a way people are waking up to how serious the problem is and they want to help. We just had Chris Hughes, the third co-founder of Facebook, publicly endorse and support our work at the center. So, you know, I think this thing really is turning.
Cool. So where can people find out about more?
Well, of course, they should follow me on Twitter.
And that's a wrap. Like me on Instagram. Retweet my tweets.
Oh, my gosh. No, please. You go to humanetech.com, where it talks more about the problem and some of the things you can do right now to take control and get involved. You know, we're trying to find more ways to bring people together who want to get activated on these issues and really help. But, you know, we're working on the policy side, the public awareness side, and working with the companies where it's helpful.
So, do you think you'll ever kind of try to run for office or anything like that to try to have an effect on this stuff?
I hadn't thought about that, but I do think that this will increasingly become a political issue, especially when it affects children and actually makes it, you know, the joke is that Facebook does bring the world closer together because both sides actually are concerned about how it affects children and in general it has too much power. So I think there's other politicians who are going to be making it a political campaign issue. I think it should be. I never thought about political office.
You should run. You should run for office, and you can use Facebook to manipulate everyone to vote for you. I'm just kidding.
I'll just tap my friends at Facebook on the shoulder to make them tilt the scales in my direction. Exactly. How would we ever know?
Well, thank you so much for taking the time today to chat. This has been a fascinating conversation, and I'm now going to go turn my phone into grayscale and see what happens.
Let's see what happens. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to my guest today, Tristan Harris. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. And don't forget to leave the greatest review in history while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work, my editors at Vanity Fair, you, the listener, and of course, thank you to my sponsor, Mattress Firm. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I will see you all next week.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.